Today is Monday, November 28th.
I'm
Nina Kurujia.
I'm Chirag Mahajan.
I'm Ariel Fornia.
And you're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. To the UBC students, or the UBC campus, the residents of Vancouver, and to our listeners of our newscast and podcast on the internet.
Right here on News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. There's nothing more for anyone to have. Here I am, here you are. Take it slow for now. Here I am.
Good evening. It's 5:10. And time for another full hour of independent news. Our headlines will cover local news from around Vancouver, provincial and federal news from across Canada, as well as news from around the world.
All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for local, independent, local, and national and international news.
But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. The United Nations released a report today documenting summary executions and torture committed by Syrian troops. The report details brutal sexual torture committed on male detainees, both adults and children, one as young as 11 years old. Researchers surmise that rapes of females go unreported because of the stigma attached. The report says at least 250 kids are among the thousands dead since the beginning of the uprising in March of this year. Supporters of Syria's president took to the streets in at least four cities today. Tens of thousands protested Arab League sanctions announced Sunday, including freezes on both foreign financial aid and on transactions with Syria's central bank. Sheikh Hamad bin Jassim al-Thani, prime minister of Qatar, said the objective is to prevent foreign military intervention.
We hope that our brothers in Syria will sign this document to stop the killings and to release the detainees and prisoners. We also want the withdrawal of all military elements from the cities. villages, and districts of Syria.
In Bahrain, 20 medical professionals were in a civilian court today, hoping their military trial sentences will be tossed out. Prosecutors presented boxes of weapons they say belong to the medics, hammers, chains, Kalashnikovs. The accused say the evidence is totally fabricated. Proceedings were adjourned until early January. Government officials also established a panel called for by the Bahraini Independent Commission of Inquiry after their report last week that accused state forces of torture, killing peaceful protesters, and arbitrary arrests. But major opposition parties say they won't participate in the panel unless the current government steps down. In Kuwait, the government did resign today. The cabinet stepped down after Prime Minister Sheikh Nasser tendered his resignation. Sheikh Nasser has resigned 7 times since 2006. The parliament dissolved 3 times. The current Kuwaiti crisis is over corruption claims and the fates of 24 opposition detainees who stormed parliament earlier this month. Voters in South Ossetia are on the verge of electing the region's first female leader. The secessionist republic broke away from Georgia and is recognized by Russia as an independent state. FSRN's Jacob Resnick reports from Tbilisi.
With more than half the ballots counted, the Election Commission reports ex-education minister Alla Giova is in the lead with 51% of the vote. Her opponent, Minister of Emergency Situations Anatoly Bibulov, trails by 1,000 votes, but unofficial results put Giova firmly ahead. The Kremlin had openly backed Bibulov, and outgoing strongman President Edward Kokoity, who is constitutionally barred from seeking another term, had dismissed Giova's electoral chances because she's a woman. But many voters have been attracted by her pro-independence platform. Her rival had hinted that South Ossetia could one day be absorbed into the Russian Federation, whereas she has been adamant that the tiny republic remain independent. Now Bibulov alleges irregularities and refuses to concede. The Supreme Court is hearing the case today and ordered official results postponed until the judges rule later this week. Georgian officials in Tbilisi dismissed the election as a propaganda exercise orchestrated by Moscow. The two sides fought a 5-day war over South Ossetia in 2008. The August war displaced about 20,000 ethnic Georgians. Jacob Resnick, FSRN, Tbilisi.
Elections in the Democratic Republic of Congo today turned violent. At least 5 people are dead at 2 voting centers. 4 others were killed over the weekend in the run-up to the vote. At least 3 polling stations were set on fire. Claims of massive electoral fraud include children registered to vote numerous times under various names. Incumbent President Laurent Kabila faces 10 challengers, but is set to win another 5 years in office. Students, faculty, and community members are rallying in New York today to oppose tuition hikes at public city colleges and to protest alleged police brutality at last week's public hearings. Jessel Noor reports from New York.
Officials at Baruch College have canceled classes after 3 p.m. ahead of today's vote on tuition increases for the city's public university students. Barricades have also been erected at the campus in anticipation of a showdown with students and faculty angered over a plan to increase tuition $500 annually for the next 5 years. The proposal is expected to pass. University officials say the tuition hikes are necessary to offset budget shortfalls due to falling tax revenue. Dominique Nisperos, a student and professor at Brooklyn College and member of the Graduate School General Assembly, disagrees.
The fact that they're saying there's not enough money, that was never the issue to begin with. This was something that they were planning before there was a recession.
The Higher Education Committee of the New York City Council has joined calls for an investigation of alleged police brutality at last week's public hearing. The New York Times reported officers beat peaceful students and faculty with batons as they attempted to enter the hearing. Jessel Noor, FSRN, New York.
A high school senior in Missouri says she won't apologize for tweeting negative remarks about the Kansas governor last week. Emma Sullivan's tweet caught the attention of Governor Sam Brownback's staff. They contacted the school, and Principal Carl Kravitz demanded she send an apology. She says while she'd be happy to talk to the governor, she won't say she's sorry. After serving 16 terms in the U.S. House of Representatives, Congressman Barney Frank announced today he will not seek re-election in 2012. The Massachusetts Democrat says he'll write, teach, and lecture, but will not lobby. Congressman Frank co-authored the Dodd-Frank bill, reining in Wall Street after the 2008 economic crisis. He says the best part of retirement is that he'll no longer have to pretend to be nice to people he doesn't like. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their full newscast can be found at their website, fsrn.org. I'm Nina Kurgia.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Mariel Fournier.
You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9, and these are your local headlines.
A major BC mining firm and a Cariboo area First Nations are in a Vancouver court today looking for court injunctions against each other. Taseko Mines wants an injunction and enforcement order against the Silcateen First Nation. Taseko's lawyer told the BC Supreme Court that the First Nations have taken the law into their own hands and obstructed a public road. Court heard Taseko has permits to explore and plan in the area, but has been prevented access to the land proposed for a massive copper and gold mine outside of Williams Lake. Outside the court, a handful of First Nations chanted and drummed in protest to the mine's application. Silcateen Chief Marilyn Baptist says that their application asking to keep the company off their lands is to protect their territory and their way of life. The first federal government environmental review of the giant mine failed, but Taseko has been granted a new assessment after the mining firms revised the proposal, including saving a lake in the First Nation considered sacred.
Jagrup Brar, MLA for Surrey Fleetwood, will follow in the footsteps of late MLA and BC Lions player Emery Barnes by going on welfare in the new year to raise awareness of poverty in BC. Brar said he will live on $610 for the month of January in an effort to gain a first-hand experience of how an estimated 180,000 British Columbians live. Given that he's an MLA, Swanson said, Brar will go to work one day out of the week and, if he so chooses, visit his family once a week as well. Raise the Rates is paying $610 and Brar will continue to collect his pay as an MLA. Brar said at Monday on a press conference in Surrey, quote, I want to live exactly the same life, as close as I can to their lives. He said, to experience that life and listen to their stories and share those stories with the people of BC. I have a dream to bring positive change and to bring some hope to the most vulnerable people in BC. Quote, end quote.
The BC budget deficit has exploded to more than $3 billion, a jump of more than $300 million in just 3 months, as the province's economy is rocked by global economic jitters. Finance Minister Kevin Falcon said the deficit is ballooning as government revenues plunge and private sector analysts downgrade the province's economic outlook. He blamed lower corporate tax revenue, lower commodity prices, and lower income from Crown corporations for the shortfall. But Falcon said the governing Liberals still hope to balance the books by 2013, which will probably mean painful and unpopular spending cuts in the run-up to the next election. He denied that the government needs the HST revenue to balance the books and said his preference would be to scrap the tax immediately and return to the former provincial sales tax.
A new report shows British Columbia continues to have one of the highest levels of child poverty in the country. In BC, the child poverty rate rose to 16.4% in 2009 from 14.5% in 2008, according to the 2011 Child Poverty Report Card. That means 137,000 children in the province were living in poverty, says the report released today, November 23rd, by the BC Child Advocacy Group, First Call. The rate of poverty for BC children under the age of 6 at 20.2% was higher than the overall rate. BC's 2009 child poverty rate was higher than all provinces except Manitoba, where it was 16.8%. BC's rate was also above the national average of 14%. The new report calls for the BC child poverty rate to be reduced by at least 7% by 2020 and urges that both the federal and provincial governments do more. Among its recommendations, the report calls for increase to the BC minimum wage and federal child tax benefits and better employment assistance and more language training for immigrants and refugees.
Those are your local headlines. We're going to take a quick break and play a couple of PSAs, but stay with us. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver.
We'd like to take a moment to thank businesses who have made generous donations to FundDrive 2011. Thank you to Fortune Sound Club, Lotus Land Tattoo, and Sanitary Electric Tattoo Company for helping us continue to provide quality alternative programming from 2011 and into the future.
We'd also like to thank our volunteer sponsors, Bilo Foods and Ethical Bean, for keeping our volunteers sated and caffeinated.
We here at CITR cannot do without your support, so thank you. If you'd like to donate to CITR's Fund Drive 2011, call 604-822-8648. That's 604-822-8648. Or go online to citr.ca/funddrive today. Get up, stand up, get up.
Welcome back to News 101. I'm Chirag Mahajan.
And I'm Nina Kurdia.
And I'm Ariel Fournier.
And you are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia. Thank you for being with us. It is now time for the national and international news.
A government bill to scrap the Canadian Wheat Board's grain marketing monopoly cleared the final stage of approval at Canada's House of Commons on Monday, leaving it all but certain to become a law next month. The bill would end the Wheat Board's six-decade-old marketing monopoly for Western Canada's wheat and barley for milling or export as of August 2012, the start of the 2012-2013 crop marketing year. The legislation faces a court challenge on December 3rd by the Wheat Board, which argues that the bill is illegal because the government did not hold a farmer vote on ending the monopoly. The government plans to help the Wheat Board survive without its monopoly by guaranteeing its initial payments to farmers and borrowings for up to 5 years.
Toronto has more HIV and AIDS cases than ever before. With an estimated of 120 adults in the city now HIV positive.
Correction, that's 1 in 120 adults.
Sorry. 1 in 120, that is way bigger. A report suggested on Monday. In all of Ontario, the number of people living with HIV/AIDS grew by 31% between 2003 and 2008, and that number continues to expand, said the report released by the Casey House to mark World AIDS Week. The face of HIV and AIDS is changing dramatically, which could bring many challenges for the province's healthcare system, and the report, Facing the Future Together. Among the findings are the fact that in Toronto, two people are newly infected every day. And on the flip side of the graying trend, the report also warns of increasing rates of injection for youth in Toronto. The report also warns of increasing rates of infection for youth in Toronto. The report was written by Kevin Gu of St. Michael's Hospital in Toronto, and Stephanie Carapita, CEO of Casey House, an HIV/AIDS hospital that offers home care and outreach programs.
In a global forecast released Monday, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development said Canada is currently going through a rough patch of wheat growth, mainly because of the deteriorating environment in Europe and a decreased demand for Canadian exports. While most of the risks stem from European contagion, Canada is not totally blameless. The OECD cites high levels of household indebtedness that are eroding consumer confidence. Recently, both the International Monetary Fund and The Economist magazine have flagged record levels of household indebtedness as risks to the Canadian economy. Household debt is at about 150% of disposable income, an all-time high. However, Canada is still better than other OECD countries, especially compared to the U.S. and many European countries, and Canada's GDP is forecast to rise slightly in 2012 by 1.9% and 2.5% in 2013.
Those were your national headlines, and now it's time for the international news. The Shabab militant group, which has already blocked many agencies from reaching starving people in Somalia's famine zones, ordered 16 more aid agencies to shut down on Monday. Heavily armed Al-Shabab fighters then raided the offices of several aid groups, looted equipment, and accused the aid workers of being spies. Many of the aid organizations were helping to deliver life-saving assistance to millions of Somalis suffering from food shortages brought on by the drought. Though heavy rains and a surge of aid supplies have eased the situation somewhat in the past month, tens of thousands have died and 250,000 people face imminent starvation. One of the few UN aid agencies that the Al-Shabaab had tolerated in the territory it controls was UNICEF, but on Monday, fighters stormed into the UNICEF office in Baidoa, a large town in southern Somalia, and kicked out the UN workers, though no one was hurt. The Al-Shabaab also banned several other UN agencies, including ones that helped monitor the famine, as well as aid agencies based in Germany, Norway, Somalia, and Sweden.
A UN investigation concluded Monday that Syrian forces committed crimes against humanity by killing and torturing hundreds of children, including a 2-year-old girl reportedly shot to death so she wouldn't grow up to be a demonstrator. The report by a UN Human Rights Council panel found that at least 256 children were killed by government forces between mid-March and early November, some of them tortured to death. The report was compiled by a panel of independent experts who were not allowed into Syria. However, the commission interviewed 223 victims and witnesses, including defectors of Syria's military and security forces. The panel said government forces were given shoot-to-kill orders to crush demonstrators. Some troops shot indiscriminately at unarmed protesters, while snipers targeted others in the upper body or head, it said.
And as you heard in the FSRN headlines, in addition to voting in Egypt, the Democratic Republic of Congo held their elections today. The Democratic Republic of Congo is the lowest-rated country in the United Nations Human Development Index. Today, the country hosted its second democratic election in the last 4 decades. So how do you run an election in a country where there are 18,000 candidates running for 500 parliamentary positions, and many ballots run up to 20 pages? All this considering that one-third of adults in the country cannot read or write. Today there have been reports of logistical confusion and violent outbreaks across the country. The BBC has confirmed that 4 people are dead from killings at polling stations. Earlier today I spoke to Jean-Philippe Marquis about what is going on at the election. Jean-Philippe is making a documentary about the election and is currently living in the West Kasai city of Lubumbashi, where voters tend to support the presidential opposition. Here's the conversation I had with Jean-Philippe.
Well, the elections were held today, everywhere in the country. And I've only seen like of Lubumbashi, the town where I am, but I visited maybe 4 voting offices, 4 or 5, and the big problem in the morning was that everything started late. Like it was supposed to start at 7:30, but at one p.m. some voting stations were just starting to like make people vote. So I'm guessing that right now people are still voting, although it was supposed to be over by 5 p.m.
Are people protesting voting or?
No, people are very, everybody wants to vote. It's just that there's, bad organization. It's always like this here. So, the voting, the material and all the paper stuff, were not put, in place properly by 7 o'clock. So people were waiting since, 5 o'clock in the morning to vote. But everything, in some offices, the material was not in place by 1 or 2 o'clock, so they had to rush and wait. They waited all day under the sun. But yeah, people are very. Everybody wants to vote very bad, but it's so complicated because of you need. You can only vote in one office, the office where you had been registered. It makes a mess because some people they lost their paper. Some people they. Their name does not appear on the list. Some candidates, they cannot even vote for. They do not appear on paper. So it's just a Yeah, it's like there's a lot of problems.
What do people do if there's a candidate's not on the ballot? Can they write it in?
We met, I don't know. The election is only 2 days. So one of the candidates, we met one today that he was not on the paper because there's 644. It's crazy. Like when you go vote, it's like you're reading a newspaper. You have like I don't know, almost 20 pages of candidates. 20 pages, that's a huge, it's like a newspaper that you have to fold and put in the box, so the box are so full, like they cannot like contain all the bills.
What was this, what were you saying though about like all the violence that's been happening there?
Yeah, they burn, there was a school to use as a voting office that was like attacked and burned by some, we don't know who did that, like it's some soldiers. But my friend called me, he lives in this neighborhood, and he says that like he heard like gunshots, like many times he heard like gunshots today, and so he did not leave the house to go vote. He like just stayed home because yeah, he could hear like the gunshots. So he told me, like, I don't know, it's not official, but he told me that two candidates were killed and one policeman and a soldier got injured. Of what I heard, like, people were like very like excited because of, you know, all this mess. And policemen here, like, I think they started like shooting in the air, and then they shoot I don't know, some people, maybe in the crowd, some people got injured. Like, it's, people here are very, very like overwhelmed, and everybody wants to vote, and there's a lot of like soldiers with like machine guns, so it doesn't take much. And but it was confirmed that like this school was burned like early this morning or yesterday at night, or so that was like, that's for sure, like everybody says it, like in this neighborhood of Lubumbashi, people, like many people stayed home, so that's another problem because people are scared, so they don't go voting.
So but are these are military soldiers?
Well, we don't, I don't know, I just read like the only like Radio Okapi says that Radio Okapi is like the only trustable media like here in the DRC. And they say those were like, no, civil, like people dressed in civil, and they just had like wearing mask with a red bandana like or around the head.
Right.
And they say they were yeah. So people say that they were like ex-soldiers or ex-policemen because they were, according to Radio Okapi, they were like trained. But I don't know, because here it works by like neighborhood, you know, like for sure, like some neighborhoods, if a candidate comes from this neighborhood, like we know like in advance that like everybody will, like who will vote for who.
So is there any idea then who's going to win?
Oh yeah, I mean, everybody says that, everybody thinks that the president that is right now in place will win. We're going to just, it will take 1 week. The new president will be announced on December 6th, and there's like 11 candidates right now for the presidency, and everybody says that it will be like the actual president. It won't change because he has like during the campaign, during the last month, like he had all the, you know, he had all the money and all the power to do his campaign and is propaganda and publicity. So if you like walk in the city, not all you see, but mostly what you see is like posters and demonstrations, and on TV it's always about this president. So it's a big, all, you know, all the media are paid by the president that is right now in place, and so we're pretty sure that the like Kabila is gonna win.
Are there any other strong candidates besides Kabila?
Yeah, there's like three. Number one is pretty much Joseph Kabila. Number two is Etienne Tshisekedi, is like the main opposition. And it's so like the big clash are between like the fans of there are three, but the main clashes that happen here in Lubumbashi are between fans of Etienne Tshisekedi, with from the Kasai. Kasai is another area of the Congo. It's a big region of the Congo, in the middle of the Congo. And a candidate here was from Lubumbashi. He's very nationalistic, pro Katanga. He wants to be Katanga to be independent. And he was responsible for some massacre in 1992. And he is very he wants only Katangese people to be in control of the Katanga and control the businesses of the Katanga. And the main oppositions is from Kasai. So Kasai and Katanga are kind of, there's tensions between the two provinces. Basically, most of the clashes that happens here in Lubumbashi was because of those two groups of people, because of those two, region of the Congo. So Kabila is number one and Tshisekedi is number two, but Tshisekedi is very old. He's 80 years old and he has been in the political area in the Congo since ever. He fought against Mobutu, so he's more so everybody who was against present governments tends to support Tshisekedi. But he's kind of a old man who has a very old way of doing politics and seeing politics. And number three is Vital Kamerhe, but he's very small beside the two of them. But it's almost, I don't know, it will be a surprise if the main opposition.
So, thanks for letting me know what's going on there, JP.
Of course. I mean, we've seen here, there's not many journalists. Seriously, in 3 months, I haven't seen, one journalist, basically. They saw that, my friend saw some BBC, the only journalist that, ever came, in this area, BBC and, some, France, TV5, something like this, or, news, France Internationale, but,
mm-hmm.
So yeah, if they want to get some, because I was not. It's funny because I was at the voting office this morning, and then I left. It was a big mess there, but we took some pictures and everything. And then I left, and then I read in the newspaper that there was some gunshot at this station. But I was away by then. So
mm-hmm.
And I visited some offices that everything was going very quietly and everything was peaceful and people were satisfied of the organizations. But in other offices, people were so mad because it was 2 o'clock, only 3 hours before that they shut down everything, and they were just starting to make people voting. So the organization was kind of a fail. It's a circus. The election here is a big circus. You have 644 candidates fighting for 13 seats. Can you imagine the amount of people who won't be chosen? The amount of people who will fail? It's huge. It's not everybody who have TV or radio. So the way to do politics here, it's driving the streets with speakers on your car and giving tracks to people, war. It's World War One propaganda technology.
Welcome. That was Ariel Fournier speaking to her friend and documentary filmmaker Jean-Philippe in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Up next, we have the weekly weather update brought to you by Ime from the Storm Club.
Well, we will have a bit of rain from tonight to tomorrow. For the rest of the week, we will have a mix of mostly sun and cloud. Here's your UBC weather forecast for this week. Tonight, increasing cloudiness, 30% chance of shower overnight. Low of +3. Tuesday, cloudy, 40% chance of shower in the morning. Rain beginning late in the morning. Becoming windy in the afternoon, high of +5. Wednesday, sunny, low of +1, high of 6. Thursday, a mix of sun and cloud, low of -1 and high of +4. Friday, sunny and low of +3, high of 6. Saturday, sunny, low of 0, high of 7. Sunday, a mix of sun and cloud, low of plus 2 and high of 7. The current temperature at UBC is 5 Celsius. The maximum temperature at this time of the year is 7 and a minimum of 2. That's all for the weather for this week. Brought to you by the Storm Club. I'm Ime Lee. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Ime. Could you tell us a bit about the storm in Calgary that happened? Have you heard about it?
Sure.
Not sure. That's okay. I heard it was like winds of 144 kilometers an hour.
There was some big winds in Vancouver last week too, actually.
Nothing compared to 140 kilometers.
I know. Yeah, I'm just saying.
They're telling people like not to outside.
What? Yeah, major damage in the downtown area and stuff. So
that is.
Yeah, I think 2 weeks ago it was like 30.
Wow. 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago.
All right. Anyway, okay. That was our weekly weather update brought to you by email from the Storm Club. Thank you so much. We stay tuned. We're going to play a couple of PSAs, but. You're listening to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the Student Union Building at the University of British Columbia.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the UBC West Side area at
The Australian Boot Company, Banyan Books, The Bike Kitchen, The Eatery, Fresh's Best Salsa, Gargoyle's Grill, Gumdrops, Prussian Music, Rufus's Guitar Shop, and the UBC Bookstore.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
Yes. The perfect party. It's an elusive idea. People have to be completely entertained from the moment they walk in to the moment they leave. It's a grand experiment.
Welcome to the future of parties, the perfect party. We here at CITR consider ourselves party scientists, and we are proud to bring you into the future of parties with our annual Fun Drive finale at the Biltmore Cabaret. The Fun Drive finale celebrates the contributions of all our Fun Drive donors with a magnificent night of local music and a legendary silent auction. Friday, November 25th, there is no place you'd rather be than at the Biltmore Cabaret. Bands include Womankind, Shimmering Stars, Synthcake, World Club, Love Cuts, Shearing Pinks, The Defectors, and more.
Advance tickets are available online at brownpapertickets.com or at your local record store.
A limited number of tickets will also be available at the door.
For more information and to check out the list of our silent auction swag, go to citr.ca or search for Fun Drive Finale on Facebook.
CITR, tune into the future with us.
I am a party scientist. Welcome to my laboratory.
Welcome back to News 101 here on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver, BC. Up next, we have the headlines brought to you by Democracy Now! And here it is.
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Since morning, the NATO supply is halted. This is good because America is bombarding our army and our people. These supplies should be stopped.
NATO kills at least 24 Pakistani soldiers. Now Pakistan has demanded Washington vacate an American drone base there. We'll get analysis. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Relations between Pakistan and the United States have deteriorated after NATO helicopters and fighter jets attacked two Pakistani military outposts Saturday, killing at least 24 Pakistani soldiers. Pakistan described the attack as unprovoked and irresponsible. Pakistan responded by demanding the U.S. vacate an airbase within 15 days that the CIA is suspected of using for unmanned drones. In addition, Pakistan has indefinitely shut down NATO supply lines through the country used by foreign forces in Afghanistan. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen described the attack as a, quote, tragic unintended incident, but unnamed NATO officials have claimed the attack occurred after NATO and Afghan forces came under fire from the military outpost. The United States has vowed to investigate the killings. Voters in Egypt are going to the polls today in the opening round of the first parliamentary election since former President Hosni Mubarak was toppled in February. The election follows 9 days of intense protests in Tahrir Square and across Egypt calling for the end of military rule. A crackdown on the protests has left at least 42 people dead and more than 3,000 wounded across Egypt. We'll have more from Cairo later in the broadcast. A major United Nations conference on climate change has just opened in the South African city of Durban. Up to 20,000 people from more than 190 nations are expected to attend the two-week conference. At a rally Sunday night, South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu described climate change as a huge enemy that threatens humanity.
We are saying this is the last chance. Please, for goodness sake, take the right decision. This is the only world we have. This is the only home we have. If it is destroyed, we all sink.
Former Irish President Mary Robinson also spoke ahead of the UN climate conference. Robinson is founder of Climate Justice Foundation.
People are suffering because of the impacts of climate, and those who are suffering most are not responsible. So the rich world has to take its responsibility. We have to have a continuation of Kyoto and a track that leads to a fair, ambitious and binding agreement. And we have to do it here in Durban.
The UN Climate Change Conference is opening at a time when South Africa is experiencing a bout of extreme weather. 8 people died in heavy flooding in and near Durban Sunday. Scores of homes were destroyed. Democracy Now! Will be broadcasting from Durban, South Africa, covering the UN Climate Change Conference inside and out all through next week. Police in Los Angeles are threatening to begin arresting Occupy Wall Street protesters this morning as part of an attempt by the city to dismantle the protest encampment located on the lawn of City Hall. Protesters and police have been in a standoff for hours. As we go to broadcast, police are threatening to make arrests of any protesters in the street near the park. Meanwhile, in Philadelphia, the city backed down from a threat to evict Occupy protesters by 5 p.m. Sunday. Here in New York City, Occupy Wall Street protesters are calling on the city to replace thousands of books lost in the eviction of the protest encampment earlier this month. In a news conference held last week, civil rights attorney Norman Siegel revealed property taken in the raid filled 26 sanitation trucks and nearly 80% of the roughly more than 5,000 books housed in the so-called People's Library were either destroyed or never returned.
Before you on this table, the condition of some of the books that were returned, damaged, not usable, not a pretty sight. The Bloomberg administration needs to replace every single book that's missing or damaged, that's not usable. Together, about 3,161 books.
In other Occupy news, Occupy Wall Street protesters in New York City mark Thanksgiving by serving roughly 4,000 hot meals in Liberty Square, the home base of the protest movement in Manhattan's financial district. Meanwhile, activists with Occupy the Hood dropped off meals in Harlem, Brooklyn, and the Bronx. In education news, students at the University of California, Davis, and other campuses have called for a general strike today to protest tuition hikes. Meanwhile, here in New York, officials at Baruch College have canceled classes after 3 p.m. today, ahead of a controversial vote to raise tuition at the City University of New York. Arab states voted Sunday to impose economic sanctions on Syria in response to Syria's violent crackdown on an 8-month uprising against the rule of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. 19 of the Arab League's 22 members voted for sanctions that include a travel ban on senior Syrian officials, freezing Syrian government assets, halting trade dealings with the central bank, and stopping Arab investment. The crackdown in Syria has left more than 3,500 people dead. A special commission in Bahrain has confirmed the Gulf nation killed and tortured dissidents during its crackdown on pro-democracy protests earlier this year. The King of Bahrain has reportedly ordered a special commission to explore recommendations issued in the wake of the massive report. Sharif Bassiouni, head of the Bahrain Inquiry, describes some of the tactics employed by the Bahraini government.
اللكم الضرب بخراطيم مطاطة.
Violent beatings, punching, hitting with rubber hoses, hitting with electric wires on the feet, hitting with sticks and metal sticks and wooden sticks and other things, and electric shocks and sleep deprivation and exposure to high temperature and verbal abuse and threats of rape and insults to religious faiths. In general, these acts come under the definition of torture according to anti-torture convention.
According to the commission, a total of 2,929 people were detained during the protests, and at least 700 remain in prison. 35 people are believed to have died in the unrest between February and March, and 11 more are suspected to have been killed later on. In addition to torture, international organizations such as Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and the United Nations Human Rights Agency have accused the government of using excessive force in carrying out unfair trials. Activist Ala Shahabi says conditions on the ground in Bahrain continue to worsen.
There's ongoing violence, there's ongoing abuses, there's a complete lack of faith that the government will even read the report, let alone implement the recommendations. And I, for one, my husband's been in jail for 8 months, and the report didn't even go as far as demanding the immediate and unconditional release of around 500 political prisoners in Bahrain today.
We'll have more with Ala Shahabi later in the broadcast. In other news from the region, five political activists detained in the United Arab Emirates have been granted a presidential pardon one day after being convicted of crimes against the state. The activists were arrested in April after they signed an online petition demanding political reforms, including free elections for parliament. Charges against the five included insulting the country's top leadership, endangering national security, inciting people to protest, and urging an election boycott. A leading advocate for the survivors of the 1984 Bhopal disaster is calling on India to boycott the 2012 Olympic Games in London because Dow Chemical is an official sponsor of the event. On December 3, 1984, around 40 metric tons of toxic gases leaked from a Union Carbide plant in Bhopal. The Indian government said soon afterwards around 3,500 people died, but campaigners estimate the total number of dead due to the leakage at 25,000, with many people still suffering. Years after the leak, Dow Chemical bought Union Carbide. Satyanath Sarangi is an activist with the Bhopal Group for Information and Action.
We are opposing Dow Chemical's sponsorship of the Olympics Games because Dow is still running away from its legal liabilities towards the victims of Bhopal, the worst industrial disaster in history. Dow, as the owner of Union Carbide Corporation, Dow Corporation is legally liable to compensate for the deaths of over 25,000 people and the poisoning and continued sickness among 500,000 people in Bhopal.
A Mexican human rights lawyer has filed a complaint with the International Criminal Court in The Hague requesting an investigation into the deaths of hundreds of civilians at the hands of the military and drug traffickers in Mexico, where more than 45,000 have died in drug-related violence since 2006. The suit alleges Mexican troops and police are regularly violating the rights of citizens in their crackdown on the cartels. In presidential campaign news, former Speaker of the House Newt Gingrich received a boost Sunday when he received the endorsement of the Manchester Union Leader, New Hampshire's largest newspaper. New Hampshire holds the nation's first presidential primary on January 10th. For the second campaign in a row, the paper has passed on endorsing former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney, despite his lead in the New Hampshire polls. The papers endorsed John McCain in the 2008 race. In the 2000 race, the paper picked Steve Forbes over George W. Bush. German police detained 1,300 anti-nuclear protesters Sunday during a sit-in to block a train carrying 150 tons of nuclear waste from France. The protest delayed the train by over 15 hours. The whistleblowing website WikiLeaks has won a major Australian journalism prize for its leaking of secret U.S. diplomatic cables. The judges of the annual Walkley Awards praised the organization by saying, quote, WikiLeaks applied new technology to penetrate the inner workings of government to reveal an avalanche of inconvenient truths in a global publishing coup. We'll have more on that award to WikiLeaks later in the broadcast. The legendary journalist Tom Wickers died at the age of 85. He covered the assassination of President John F. Kennedy for the New York Times. Years later, he became a vocal critic of the Vietnam War and was invited by the prisoners at Attica to serve as a mediator during the 1971 prison uprising. Meanwhile, Richard Grossman, a longtime critic of corporate power, has died at the age of 68. He was the founder of the program on corporations, law, and democracy, and was co-author of the book Taking Care of Business, Citizenship and the Charter of Incorporation. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Sunday, Pakistan's powerful army chief, General Ashfaq Pervez Kayani, led mourners in prayer at the
Those were the international headlines brought to you by Democracy Now! For more headlines, please go to their website at democracynow.org.
And that's our program for Monday, November 28th. Yeah, that's it. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or give us a hot news tip, please contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334. That is 604-822-5334. Or you can email news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter with the username CITRNews. We even have Facebook. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at CITR.ca. For more news, join us on Mondays and Fridays at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Nina Kurgia.
And I'm Chirag Mahajan. Today's show was produced by Iqbal Ahmed. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Sore Throats and Clapping Hands with your host, Robert, at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Do something 100 times, and you can show your friends. Do something.